All right. So, official welcome to tonight's Climate Science and Health Ask Me Anything. I'm excited to join CCL's research coordinator, Dana Nucitelli, for our quarterly AMA series this evening, April 30th. Dana is joined by Dr. Lisa Patel, Executive Director of the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health from the Stanford School of Medicine.
So we got Dr. Lisa Patel. She received her bachelor's degree in biological sciences from Stanford, master's degree in environmental science from Yale, and her medical degree from Johns Hopkins University. And then she completed her residency in pediatrics at UCSF. Dr. Patel was the co-chair for the American Academy of Pediatrics Advocacy Committee, California Chapter 1. And in her time there, she helped launch the inaugural Advocating for Children Together conference for Northern California. For the last several years, she's used her extensive experience working for government, community organizations, and nonprofits to advocate for children's health priorities in the US. She's currently the executive director for the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health and maintains a clinical practice as a pediatric hospitalist caring for newborns, premature infants, and children requiring hospitalizations. And Dr. Patel also sits on the board of Our Children's Trust, the legal organization that represented youth in Held v. Montana. Her work has appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, the New York Times, the LA Times, Bloomberg News, and multiple state and local outlets. She's interviewed regularly for her expertise on climate, health, and equity for major national media outlets like the Washington Post, US News and World Report, and CNN, among others, and lots of other stuff that I cut out of her bio because she's done a lot of cool things. So, Dr. Patel, thank you for joining us tonight. And the floor is yours to tell us about some cool stuff that you want to tell us about.
Great. I just do want to take a moment and say a shout out to my friends that I learn so much from every day and draw inspiration from. So, Dr. Del Buono and Dr. Rob and Lori Byron, Joanne, we advocated together on Capitol Hill, and I still remember those visits, and that was great. And Rhonda as well. I appreciate all of the advocacy y'all do as health professionals for climate and health. And I draw inspiration from you, and I'm looking forward to the other folks that I haven't met yet that are here tonight because we're all in this together.
Yeah. And also, I forgot to say, everybody, if you have questions or as your questions pop up, use the Q&A button at the bottom of the Zoom, and then you can vote people's questions up, and then we'll ask the upvoted questions first.
Yep. So I was initially an environmental scientist. I worked for the Environmental Protection Agency. I am a daughter of Indian immigrants. And so the expectation was always that I was going to become a doctor. And so at some point in my training, I realized that I was really missing that service component in terms of my work. And so decided to go to medical school. And at the time, I felt like there was some connection there. I couldn't really articulate it in the moment, but it became very clear to me in the 2019 youth movement where that connection was and where my work needed to be. I had recently, I not recently, but semi-recently finished my training, had become a new mom, a new doctor. I thought I would have time to settle into being a new mom and a new doctor, and then we withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord. And I realized in that moment that I'd always assumed I'd been studying climate change since I was a voting age, and I'd assumed that no rational person who was reading the evidence would not act with the seriousness and the boldness we needed to address the climate crisis. And when we withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord, I realized how naive I was. And so I dropped everything I was doing and started initially working just in the advocacy space because when I started doing this work in 2017, there weren't a lot of health professionals that I could find anyway that were working on climate change in particular. And then it felt like in 2019, thanks to the youth movement, suddenly there were a lot of health professionals that were engaged on this issue. And that's when I've really found momentum for my work. I live in Northern California, and so we unfortunately have been experiencing the impacts of climate change for many years now, mostly in the form of wildfires and heat events. And so I'm a community pediatric hospitalist. I work for a small community hospital that sits, we're kind of the last mass hospital before you enter the Yosemite Hills. And so I care for newborn infants that are on Medi-Cal, and I care for premature infants and children with simple medical problems that don't need to go to a higher level of care. So this was one of my many awakenings. I would say that I think for any of us that work in the field of climate change, we probably, there was like one big awakening moment. But for me, there were multiple events throughout my life that increasingly showed what those links were and where my place should be. So I remember walking into the NICU in 2020, and there was overwhelming wildfire smoke outside, and I walk inside and it reeked of wildfire smoke. So premature infants, 32 weeks and up, were breathing in that foul smoke, which some studies show that can be up to 10 times as toxic as regular air pollution. And in that moment, I felt like I could make things marginally better. We got some extra air purifiers in there. I went around talking to the families about what mitigation we were taking to make their babies safe. And it felt like in the moment that I could address it. Well, fast forward, in that same year, we were also dealing with the pandemic, school closures. This is a picture of my two children when we had closures in San Francisco over the pandemic. My daughter was 5. She was entering elementary school. And so she actually started elementary school on Zoom, like many other children did. Because my expertise was on in environmental science, I actually got drawn into conversations around indoor air quality, which was not at all my area or frankly, even my interest, but it was a huge need in the Bay Area because there were a lot of public health officials that didn't know what to do. We didn't have the resources. We didn't have the knowledge. We were not prepared for it. And so I quickly read up and became an expert on indoor air quality. So I would talk to school districts about opening up the windows if they didn't have HVAC systems, only to learn that a lot of schools had their windows painted shut because they lived in over-policed neighborhoods where they were concerned about safety. I would talk to schools about having a MERV 13 filter to filter out the wildfire pollution, only to learn that actually schools have in California have a $10 billion infrastructure gap in terms of our investment and didn't have HVAC systems to even do so. And so I started actually attaching a lot of my energy into thinking about how we think about public infrastructure and how we prepare for climate change. And so anticipating my own daughter started school on Zoom in kindergarten, I started doing a lot of work around thinking about how our public schools could use federal funding to be prepared for when schools were to reopen. And what I was concerned about in California was that we reopened schools. They were expecting to open the windows to be able to mitigate risk for COVID, but then wildfires would happen at the same time. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. I'm missing a slide here. The next slide that I'd hoped to have was one that was showing that in San Francisco Unified School District, where my daughter is, they were expecting to open the windows. But when the wildfires blew in, I actually got a call from a public health official in San Francisco asking, she said, which one is worse? Is it worse to make the kids sit outside and breathe that wildfire smoke in with their masks off so they can eat? Or is it worse for them to sit inside with their masks off and risk the transmission of COVID, but they're protected from the wildfire smoke? And I was thinking to myself, this is insane, right? We should not be placing our children in harm's way, one way or another. And what a failure it is in terms of our planning and how we think about the climate and any of these collective crises in terms of how we're thinking about children's health. After this, I actually had the opportunity to write a school report on how to think about climate resilient schools across the state, where I was able to work with a number of school partners, which was super exciting. The White House just held a big forum on climate resilient schools. Also super exciting. This is to say that these moments of crisis, these moments of agony that we feel also are moments for us to think about our solutions. And I really encourage you all to think about what is it that's really personal to you and what is it that really drives you? Because when we really access those points of passion and what really drives us, we bring people in to the movement and we can really drive a difference in our narrative and where we attach our resources and the conversation. So I think many of you here are probably health professionals. I don't need to convince you that climate change is here. It is now. It is us. I've been studying climate change since I was an undergraduate in college, when climate change was presented as an ecosystem problem for the polar bears in a faraway place, in a faraway time, in a faraway species. And I love polar bears. But what I've learned in my work is that we need to create political will for our solutions. And what our research shows is that when we make climate change an issue of us, when we make climate change an issue of what we are leaving the present and future generations, it is hugely activating and is depolarizing. Unfortunately, climate change has become a politicized, polarizing issue. And the best way to depolarize it is to talk about it like it is an issue of health, which it profoundly is. I really like the statement from the Lancet Countdown: every child born today will be affected by climate change. How we respond will determine the world we live in tomorrow and will shape the health of children across the globe at every stage of their lives. I had the opportunity to write an op-ed with a wonderful colleague in Michigan, Dr. Alex Raven, who's a pulmonary critical care doctor. And he was experiencing in Michigan that wildfire smoke for the first time. So he and I worked together on a piece for the New York Times last July, where we actually make the argument that climate change will be the single greatest determinant of health for a child born today. So like I said, you know, what the work we do, I'm the executive director for the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, and the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health convenes health professionals, and that includes, now we're up to 58 medical, major medical societies and 25 state clinician groups, of which a number of you who are listening are leaders for the state clinician groups, to talk about climate change as an issue of health inequity. And what we're hoping is that when you hear the words climate change, the image that comes to mind isn't necessarily just the polar bear, but what comes to mind is this picture, is the picture of a child. And we know particularly children who are in low-income households, children of color, are the ones that suffer disproportionately from the impacts of fossil fuel pollution and climate change. And this is because our sites of fossil fuel production, extraction, refinement are not accidental. They happen more often in communities that are perceived to have less political power. And that tends to be communities that have been traditionally redlined and communities that have lower income. And so I work as a pediatric hospitalist, and so many of the kids, and I've just lost count over the years that I am treating, that are coming in not just with an asthma exacerbation, but a severe asthma exacerbation. An asthma exacerbation severe enough to land them in an ICU. And it's usually not their first visit to an ICU. And it tends to be children of color and children that are experiencing poverty. 200 major medical journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, BMJ, and The Lancet, in an unprecedented move, published the same editorial on the same day, calling climate change the greatest health threat to public health in the 21st century, and calling on our decision makers to act to keep our global temperatures below a rise of 1.5 degrees. I hope this activates people more than it depresses people, but all of our projections say that we are going to blow past the 1.5. And so really, we're trying to keep the temperatures below 2 degrees. What a lot of the projections show is that we can reasonably adapt it to 1.5. There will be harm that is experienced by populations, and particularly populations that live in lower and middle income countries. But this is a temperature that we can adapt to. 2 degrees and above, we start to talk about impacts that are catastrophic, and it becomes increasingly hard for us to adapt to those temperatures. We've already seen a lot of impacts from that. So hospitals and morgues filled up in 2023 in India. For folks that have not read Ministry for the Future, I encourage you to do so when you're in a good mental health day. It's not a good book if you're experiencing a poor mental health day from the work that we do here. But just to attach some imagination to what the climate crisis is going to look like if we do not address it with the boldness and seriousness that we need. We anticipate that vast areas of South Asia and Middle East will be uninhabitable. And this is because there's a maximum temperature at which our bodies can survive, so that the proteins, the molecular structure that makes up our very bodies, there's a temperature at which they start to denature, and that we cannot survive. And so we understand from experiments that that's about 115 degrees with minimal humidity, at rest, drinking water continuously. And we saw vast parts of South Asia actually blow past those temperatures last summer. We're expecting this summer to be similar to worse because of this El Nino to La Nina event that we're experiencing. Many island nations we expect to disappear in this century. So certainly maybe towards the tail end of my lifetime, and certainly during the lifetime of my own children. I cannot emphasize this enough, the fact that one third of an entire nation, so the country of Pakistan, one third of Pakistan was underwater. I was actually on a panel with the national security expert last Friday, who was talking about how the military previously had assumed in their planning for climate change that it would be somewhat like a graphed line where the impacts would slowly get worse. And now the way they're thinking about climate change is like a series of nuclear bombs that's going to go off over time. And so as we think about things like what happened in Pakistan, that is essentially like a bomb going off. A third of the country became flooded. And this was just one event. We can expect more of these events to happen over time with increasing frequency in more places. And then wildfires of unprecedented scale in new places. It was interesting to me last summer. I've become an expert on wildfire smoke, not by choice. Because I live here, because it was an expertise that was needed, I became an expert on wildfire smoke. And I was doing so many interviews on wildfire smoke on the East Coast because it was the first time so many localities were experiencing that threat, and they were wholly unprepared for it because this was not a threat that they were expecting. This was not a threat that they were prepared to deal with. And that's what we can expect. I really love the phraseology from Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She says that it's not global warming so much as it is global weirding, where we can expect strange and unexpected events in new places, new threats that people won't anticipate because we are entering a period of uncertainty where we've geoengineered our environment in a way that that is very hard for us to predict what the outcome is going to be. I used to do a lot of work in global health. So I've lived in many countries and done a lot of work in places like Guatemala and Brazil and Egypt and India. After I became a mother and after the 2016 election, I actually turned to doing all my work for domestic. And I do that as a way to be global. And that's because if the U.S. fails to lead, if we don't demonstrate the solutions, I don't see how the rest of the world is going to commit to similar solutions. So I profoundly believe that not only because we've contributed to 25% of the world's total emissions to date, but also because of the leadership we hold in the world, it is incumbent upon us to show the solutions and demonstrate the solutions to show other countries how it can be done and that we ourselves are committed to solving the crisis when we've contributed so much to the crisis to date. This is just to say there is still, unfortunately, a lot of skepticism, a lot of misinformation that is being sown by interests that would rather ensure that the oil and gas industry continues to profit at the expense of our health. And so it is so important what we know, two things that we know from the communications literature. One is that the health message is resonant. Health messengers are extraordinarily resonant, and that when we call out who the enemy is, many people are hesitant to do so. But some of our new research from John Kotcher and Ed Myback shows that it is actually beneficial to call out who the villain is in this story, because when we don't call out the villain gets fiddled by other perverse forces. So people will say, oh, it's the Soros brothers are spreading misinformation, or they will fill it in. in with whatever villain fits their narrative to protect their profits. So it is incumbent upon us to talk about who the villain is, so that the public can attach their energies and their ire at the forces that need to change and need to be held to account for their actions so far. With that, I'm going to stop. I have so much more that I can say, but I'd really love to hear folks' questions, and I would love to hear from folks in terms of the work that you're doing to help inform the work at the consortium.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Battelle. And you guys can ask Dr. Battelle anything. So if you have a question, pop it in the Q&A, or you could probably also use the Zoom tool to raise your hand and just ask it over the video. I've got a question, actually, because I've seen research saying that wildfire smoke is like 5 or 10 times more hazardous than other air pollution, but I don't know why. So can you explain why that is?
Yeah, so when we burn fossil fuels, it is one source of pollutant, right? We're burning a carbon source of fuel. But when wildfires burn, particularly in urban areas, an entire house or car goes up in flames. So we're talking about metals. We're talking about various chemicals that get aerosolized that are more carcinogenic, more toxic to us than just pure PM2.5 pollution. So it's the fact that other things that we are burning beyond just a carbon source of fuel.
And is that still true if it's like a wildfire that's limited pretty much to forests, or is there like still enough human stuff in forests that burns too?
Really good question. So we've had some research actually on prescribed burns, and the health effects of prescribed burns is actually much less than a traditional wildfire. And so that's research from Mary Prunicki out of Stanford. And that's good evidence for the fact that we should be doing more prescribed burns to basically prevent some of the really adverse effects from the wildfires that we're seeing.
That's interesting. Cool. And then Westa asked how you can get the op-ed with the 200 different journals, which I think Lisa provided the links to Lancet and a New York Times summary article in the chat. And then Westa, did you have another question too?
First, a couple of acknowledgments. I first got active in advocating in the healthcare area back in the early 70s when the medical societies were actively opposing me with regard to health maintenance organizations. So I am thrilled by the work that you're doing and the emergence of medical societies as advocates for addressing climate change and educators for waking us all up as to the consequences. Secondly, I have a question about specialties. Now, clearly, children are at risk, major at risk. I understand those of us who have lived experience in mental health are major at risk. Who else? Probably not the people visiting the orthopods, but maybe.
So when we think about vulnerability from an academic lens, we divide it into three populations by sensitivity, by exposure, and by adaptive capacity. And so when we think across those three, children are vulnerable across all three. They're sensitive physiologically. They tend to be more exposed because they spend more time outside. And then they have lesser ability to adapt because they're vulnerable in terms of decisions that adults make on behalf of their safety. Elderly individuals are extraordinarily vulnerable, especially during periods of heat wave. And we saw evidence of that during the Paris heat waves, for example, disproportionate mortality amongst the elderly, not just because of the propensity for more chronic medical conditions, but also the concern for more social isolation. So we know that people that are more socially connected or checking in on each other more are probably less vulnerable because they have more ability for people to check in, make sure they're hydrated, make sure they're okay, bring them food, water, and other things, or help them down the stairs, for example, if they need to get to a cooler place. Incarcerated individuals, highly vulnerable. And we saw a lot of that last last summer in places like Texas and California for the same reason, frankly, that children are vulnerable, right? Like a child can't say, I'm too hot in a classroom and get up and leave, nor can an incarcerated individual say, I'm too hot in my cell and be able to exit that cell. So there's a lot of work we need to do to ensure that incarcerated individuals are safe. Pregnant individuals are very, very sensitive for reasons of physiology. That evidence, I would say, is newer, very concerning in terms of risks for premature birth, low birth weight, and emerging evidence for stillbirth. And these outcomes are inequitable, as are so many health outcomes, with Black mothers in particular experiencing the brunt of it as we think about drivers for both pollution and for climate change. And then individuals with chronic medical conditions, so hypertension, diabetes, people that are on seizure medications, people with chronic cardiovascular disease, people with mental illness, all of these individuals with these both these diagnoses and the medications that they're on need specialized management during periods of extreme weather events and access to care. So my brother is actually emergency medicine. He works in Texas, and he was working when that polar vortex came through and the power cut in that many parts of Texas. And he said that the emergency room was flooded by patients who relied on medical equipment and didn't have the electricity to keep it going. That's what the emergency room was filled with. And so we need to be thinking about, well, how do we ensure that our patients that are reliant upon electricity for their medical care or need insulin, right, that's refrigerated, how do we ensure that they can maintain access to those critical life-saving equipment or medication during times of climate distress?
So Elizabeth,
one more thing while I have the floor, I want to thank you. I'm part of the New Hampshire Climate Health Group, and we wouldn't exist without y'all. So special thanks in regard to that.
Thank you. And I'll say, I put a shout out for Dr. Safferty. She actually founded the consortium because she was more forward thinking than I think many of us, and founded the consortium understanding how important and how powerful the health voice could be on climate change.
So Elizabeth, I think, wanted you to elaborate on who's the villain that you were referencing earlier. That was for you, Dr. Patel. Who's the villain?
The villain.
Yeah.
So the research is specific in this regard, and we need to be careful. For folks that, I don't know if anybody listens to Climate One, there was a really, really great segment on the rural energy transition. It was called Talking Dirty to Clean Energy. And they interview, he's the son of coal miners who himself has started a solar power organization. And what really resonated with me as a health professional, and not in any way to equate them because they're quite different. But what resonated with me was when he was talking about how his family, they've literally sacrificed their health, their lives to power this country. That is the narrative that they've been given from the coal companies in terms of Black lung disease and premature mortality. And they hold that with great pride, is to say that, yes, they've sacrificed their life. Yes, they've sacrificed their health, but it was so that the rest of the country could hold power. And where it resonated with me was, I remember when the pandemic hit, I had two young kids. We did not have adequate PPE. And I still had to go into that hospital, not knowing what the risk was going to be to me or my family to serve my country, to serve the population that I worked with. Right. And it turned out that the risk to me was not as great as I was worried about at the beginning. But it just completely reframed for me how I thought about this issue altogether. And so I'm very careful about how we villainize, because I don't want to make any worker who works in the fossil fuel industry feel like they are the villain. They are not. The villains are the CEOs. The villains are the lobbyists who fund and spread misinformation. We live in a capitalist economy. And so we're also very careful to not take any positions on the type of economy that we live in. I might have my own personal opinions about it, but to say everybody is allowed to sell their product, but we should sell our product and be honest about it, right? We shouldn't have to lie to people to sell our product. To the point that we lie, we have crossed a line. And that is where fossil fuel companies, tobacco companies, sugar companies have crossed a line and should be held accountable, because you can sell your product, but you should not lie to us about what the damages for those products are, or mislead us into thinking that they're somehow okay or better than other ways of how we utilize products, I guess.
Well, thanks. And then Christian says, thank you so much for the great presentation. Do you have practical advice to citizens not currently working in the climate air quality space on how to activate their community to be climate advocates? Where do we start?
So I would say, once I'm done talking, I'll drop a few links for y'all in the chat about some messaging guides that we have on climate and health. And I would say, even if you're not a health professional, framing climate change as a health issue, and particularly amongst conservatives, you know, what I say is that if you're in a very conservative area where climate change is even toxic terminology, don't talk about climate change. Talk about air pollution. Because climate change is driven by the burning of fossil fuels, which does both things. It drives carbon pollution that results in climate change. It drives PM 2.5 pollution that results in premature mortality. So fine, if somebody doesn't believe in climate change or global warming, you can just leave that aside and talk about the other impact, which I think is very resonant with folks, because they've probably felt it, seen it, have somebody in their family that is suffering from the ill effects of it. Talk about air pollution. We know that it is very resonant, especially amongst conservatives. And if you're tackling air pollution, you are tackling the climate crisis. So find the messaging that works for your community, and let's go at it that way.
Thanks so much. Lisa, thanks so much for coming on and for all your work. And I apologize. I had to take a phone call and I may have missed a few minutes of what you said. Going back to wildfire smoke and particulate pollution, you know, one of CCL's policy priorities is electrification of buildings to reduce fossil fuel consumption in buildings and building efficiency as well. And when I talk about that policy priority, I often reference the work of Drew Schindel and others who've done economic modeling about the health savings that would be involved. However, last week, the American Lung Association released its State of the Air report, and in my state, Nevada, particulate pollution actually went up from 2020 to 2022, largely because of wildfires. So my question is, it seems that especially in the West here, we have only a limited ability to both forecast and remediate the harmful effects of wildfires going forward. How much do you think about that and think that it relates to costs and also to messaging? If we do everything we can in buildings, we're still going to have particle pollution from wildfires. So I'm just curious how you think about that and how you frame it.
Yeah. Is that okay if I use some curse language? So really okay with that. I often say we're caught between a rock and a hard place with a shitstorm coming from up top, right? And that's what living in the West with the wildfires feels like, is that it is impossible. I mean, this goes back to the situation with the kids. Do they eat outside with the wildfire smoke, or do they eat inside with the COVID? And so the way I talk about it is, the amount of exposure, the time of exposure matters. And so if we can reduce exposures that are modifiable, wildfire smoke is a harder one to modify. They will take a longer time to modify because they depend on our policies, which we absolutely need to be working on. Our indoor environments, however, are modifiable. So if we can reduce our exposures from gas stoves, if we can install MRF 13 or higher filters, put in portable air filters, this is a way for us to create indoor air quality environments that are safer than if we didn't take those actions at all. So we can take those actions, plus we need to continue working on policies to clean up our air to prevent wildfires from getting worse. And I know that's not a perfect answer, but this is also, I've recently work for an organization that is thinking about taking a grant from the Department of Energy on promoting more nuclear. And I wrote back saying, no, like, I'm not ready to throw in the towel to say that we need to go whole hog on renewable energy. But I'm worried from hearing these forces that are very interested in nuclear, because to go for nuclear to me is to say that we're giving up, to say that we don't think that we're going to get to a transition to renewables fast enough for how quickly this crisis is accelerating. And so, you know, I'm trying to, at the same time, balance. I think we need to stay flexible in our thinking of what is going to be the most protective for human health. And I can't say that what I'm going to say today is the same thing that I'm going to say next year. But this is where I am right now, which is that I still think that we can get there. And I still think we need to fight for all renewables to both mitigate wildfire smoke and to ensure a healthier future for all of us.
And we got a question from Rhonda, who asks, given the number of impacts worldwide to our food supplies and supply chains and farm workers from a bunch of different types of extreme weather, do you think we're responding adequately to climate's impacts to our food and water supplies? And how can we elevate this concern to motivate more work on climate solutions?
No. And I think you should reach out to Lisa Del Buono, who's doing really great work on farm policy. We are doing a big push. I have read that the Democrats plan to release their version of the farm bill tomorrow. We at the consortium, we do not lobby. We do educate our lawmakers on policy, and we have developed a lot of policy guidance around farm policy. And so, Lisa, if you don't mind being a point person for information about farm policy and potentially lobbying, since your organization can do so, I would appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, Lisa does great stuff. I think the last we heard, the Republicans are going to release their farm bill and Democrats are going to release their farm bill, and then they're not going to have agreement. It's going to get kicked to next year is the last we heard. So we're going to be working on that for a while, I think. I see a question from James in the chat. What's your take on the contribution of civil engineering and construction to climate change?
This is all hands on deck. And I think when I worked with a lot of students, and so they often ask me, well, what should I do in my career to have the greatest impact on climate change? And I say, what are you the most passionate about? That is the way you can have the greatest impact on climate change, because we have to reimagine how we do everything, right? From the way we commute, to the way we use power, to the way we eat, to the way we commute, all of it. And so to me, the question isn't like, what should you do? It's that Ayanna Johnson has this really famous Venn diagram of, what needs doing, what are you passionate about, and what skills need doing. And so the civil engineering question to me falls into there's so much opportunity in the engineering space. And I have such deep respect for my civil engineering colleagues as they think about creative new ways to think about how we think about the design of our cities, how we think about energy use that I think are way beyond my intelligence, but I really respect the work that they do.
Thanks. And then I see in the chat, Rob and Lori Byron put in a plug for the CCL Health Action Team. If you want to talk to or work with a healthcare professional, that is a very good resource. I had another question about particular vulnerability of children compared to adults, since they have less developed bodies, less developed lungs. Are they more vulnerable to like wildfire smoke and heat, and like what kind of different climate change impacts are they more vulnerable to than adults are?
Yeah, so my colleague at Children's Environmental Health Network, NSA Witherspoon, and this is her phraseology, she says, children are born pre-polluted. There was a study that came out last year, the year before, where they did, it was a pathology study that found evidence of PM 2.5 pollution in a developing fetus's lung, brains, and liver. And what's concerning about that, you know, I get a lot of questions, well, what does that mean? We don't know, but we know that PM 2.5 pollution is really detrimental to health. And what's concerning is that the exposure window is much longer than any of us knew, right? If you're exposed to it before you've even taken first breath, that should be very concerning to all of us. Children are vulnerable from the time they're in utero. The placenta is not some steel box that protects you from all the environmental toxins you're exposed to it, even while you're developing. And then you're born and children breathe faster, so pound for pound, they're breathing in more toxins and air pollution. They spend some more time outside, so they're more exposed to it. Their lungs, their immune system, their brains are rapidly developing. Brains are rapidly developing in the first 2 years, lungs very rapid development in the first five. And so for all of these reasons, children are extraordinarily vulnerable to things like heat and air pollution. You add into all of this the burden of toxic stress or adverse childhood events. So we know that for every childhood event, adverse childhood event, up to four. So everyone adds more risk for a litany of physical and mental health outcomes. Once you get to four, it's become some tipping point, which like much multiplies your risk for things like cardiovascular disease and diabetes and mental health issues. And so what concerns me about climate change is that we're talking about disrupting a child's normal life. We're talking about increasing the incidence of poverty and housing insecurity and food insecurity and a caregiver that has mental health illness. All of these things compound. And so for all of those reasons, children are so vulnerable. And then one other factor that I'll put into this mix that has been a big passion of mine, which has been children's access to education. And I did a lot of this learning, again, not because I wanted to, but because this came up during the pandemic, how much learning loss children, especially children of color, children experiencing poverty, have experienced from the pandemic. We can expect that those learning losses are going to accumulate with climate change because our schools are unprepared to deal with heat, to deal with wildfire, to deal with floods. Whether a child reads by the age of four is a good marker for whether they'll graduate high school. Whether a child graduates high school is a good marker for their lifetime of health. And so as we think about how we're setting children up for their lives, climate change is going to be a huge disruptor in terms of their physical and mental health for all of it.
And Tamara just asked, at what age are people no longer children in regard to these health concerns?
Such a good question. It depends on who you talk to. So lung development, and I understand this from Alex, who I wrote the New York Times piece with, lung development, I think, finishes between the ages of 21 to 25, if I remember this correctly from Alex. Your prefrontal cortex, and I know this for males because I have a son, does not reach full maturity also until you are 25. And this is why there are a lot of cases in terms of juvenile justice. When you hold like a 14-year-old accountable for murder, it's not right because a 14-year-old's prefrontal cortex is not fully mature. And so this is to say that these periods of development go on much longer than I think a lot of people think. In terms of ultimate development and long-term health.
That's interesting. I've also seen that there's like increasing research linking dementia and some other mental problems to air pollution. I guess it's a neurological.
So I was asked to speak at this conference in Napa, actually, and it was folks that were working in women's reproductive care and geriatric care that came together to hold this conference, and they asked me to talk about climate change. And so the person that came right after me, she puts up the slide. She was talking about Alzheimer's, and she was going through the list, and she was like, air pollution. She's like, oh, so that's like what the prior speaker was just talking about, like, right? Like, we're used to listing all these things, but I don't think it entered her consciousness as an expert on dementia until she heard me talk about PM 2.5. And that evidence is really concerning in terms of our risks for Alzheimer's disease, dementia. The other thing she talked about was alcohol. We'd all plan to go to Napa after, we'd all plan to go to visit a winery, and there's nothing as much of a downer. It's alcohol as a neurotoxin causing Alzheimer's. And so we all just sat around and ate some fruit instead. But yes, fossil fuel pollution is also linked to brain conditions like dementia and Alzheimer's.
Do we know what caused that link?
I might turn to Lisa Del Buono. I don't know if she has an answer as a pathologist. Yeah, I would expect it's inflammation similar to all the other ways that PM2.5 plays out in the rest of the body. But Lisa, do you have an answer?
And I don't have an answer. Oh. Thank you. I will look that up and I will get that to you, Dana, because I quote that all the time. And I should have looked at what the pathophysiology is, and I don't know it, but I will make that my homework assignment. So thank you.
Thanks. From what I've seen, like, it wasn't entirely clear, but I was hoping like maybe there had been some more recent research that it kind of made some connection.
There was a paper out recently because it was either on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times on PM2.5 and dementia, if I remember this correctly, but I don't remember reading. It's probably some pathway linked to inflammation.
Joanne says something about absorbing into the circulation and having an inflammatory effect. Mm.
Well, we are nearing the top of the hour, and I just want to respect everybody's time. And thank you so much, Lisa, Dr. Patel, for your presentation, for your expertise, for your commitment to this topic, and for spending an hour with us this evening when you could be hanging out with your little ones cooking dinner. I'm only saying that because you mentioned dinner before, not to imply that you should be the one to cook dinner. But let me share a couple of things, go back to screen share here, and wrap us up for the evening. So I do want to just mention that if you liked this evening, if you have ongoing questions or ideas that you'd like to share, we have a Nerd Corner for the nerd curious on CCL community. Join Dana and many others in discussion at Nerd Corner. That's cclusa.org/nerd-corner. You can log your training through each of our trainings at the end on the big green button or through our interactive trainings on the log your training section, or you can also do it through the action tracker. Sorry, I went a little fast. Through chapter and volunteer development, and then you just start typing the first four letters of the name of the training and you will see it in the dropdown. So thank you very much for joining us this evening. To find tonight's recording, you can head on over to cclusa.org/YouTube. If you would like to join CCL, should you be new to CCL this evening, we would love to have you come explore our organization, cclusa.org/join. And we've got Dr. Patel's website. Or the connection is medsocietiesforclimatehealth.org. Thank you to each of you for being here this evening. We really appreciate your interest and commitment and everything you do for the climate. And I wish you a wonderful rest of your evening. Feel free to unmute and say good night. Actually,
thanks so much. Thank you, Dr. Patel. You always rock it. You're awesome. I just love listening to you. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration.
Like what you hear? Recommend us to your friends and make sure to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us show up on other listeners' feeds. Feel free to pass on any suggestions for future episodes in the comments as well.
And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.